Hello, and welcome to a special episode of the Coos Beauty Podcast, in which I will be answering your questions. So we got a huge response and some really, really interesting questions. So I can't promise I'll be able to answer them all, but rest assured, we will do another at some point. And there are even some questions that were, you know, interesting and broad enough to do a whole podcast or video on. They were that good. So yeah, let's just go straight into it. The first one is from Yatinako, who says, can you talk about if moles or other beauty marks on a face are considered attractive? Does it differ between a man and a woman, or male and female? So yeah, thank you for that question. That's that was probably my favorite, to be honest, because it's something I have recently been thinking about, actually. I even thought of doing a video on it, actually, before I realized there was no significant literature on the topic. And you know, us at Coos, we try to be as factual and literature based as possible, but you know, since we're doing a Q&A, what the hell, I can speculate a bit. All I can say about that is, despite being a heterosexual man, I think I can put my own preferences aside and just judge things objectively. And in my experience, I have never seen a mole not worsen the appearance of a man, just personally. Not that I've never seen an attractive man with a mole, but it would just be better if it was removed or not there. And as for women, I wouldn't go as far as to say that it improves their looks necessarily, although of course we do have the phenomenon of using makeup to create a beauty spot. But I don't necessarily think it worsens a woman's look, at least not always.
Just to interject, my two cents on the mole question would be that moles probably do reduce your physical attractiveness because they represent an anomaly in your skin. And as we covered in our earlier videos on skin and skin health, anything that makes your skin not look smooth or homogeneous can be considered a hit to your attractiveness because it represents that there is something unusual about you, such as a mole, which can be a defining characteristic, but in most cases it does reduce your physical attractiveness and it is usually better to get it removed.
But anyway, going back to freckles, they are obviously seen as attractive because they're quite neotenous, so they're quite youthful looking. Children tend to have them more, and in fact I actually used to have them when I was a child. Because children tend to have fairer skin, because I think that vitamin D synthesis is actually very important for their development. And you might also note that pretty much every single Caucasian or European baby is born with light-colored or non-brown eyes. So that's probably part of it as well. And secondly, they also give the appearance of more symmetry because they are randomly but also quite evenly spread across the face and around the nose.
To clarify what Simon has said, so with the question of moles versus freckles, both are very similar melanocytes, so concentrations of melanin, but with moles, they're asymmetric, and he makes a very good point there. With freckles, they're often symmetric and they're seen as more systematic in a sense that since moles are asymmetric, it's this kind of thing that happens like a pimple. You know, a pimple, we wouldn't call a pimple a physical feature of your face, whereas freckles can be seen as a structural or some kind of physical aspect of your face. They can be a defining feature, but most people don't often define their physical aesthetic by their moles. They often define it by, say, freckles, like that freckled girl over there. So in that sense, it could just be also how we, as in societal terms, actually look at the perception of freckles versus moles. There's a reason why freckles are seen as attractive or a desirable feature to have, whereas with moles, they can be seen as unattractive or some kind of skin anomaly.
Secondly, we've got SW. How does a hijab affect, influence attractiveness? That's a really interesting question, and I just so happened to have actually seen a few articles on this about a week ago in, you know, while doing research for another video. I think the problem with this issue is that it's so full of cultural bias. Just like if you remember that mask study that we spoke about, about a month ago now, or 2 months ago, where during a pandemic, masks were found to be more attractive, whereas not in a pandemic or before the pandemic, it was found to be less attractive. It's really difficult to detach the cultural biases from the actual, you know, aesthetic effect of masks or hijabs in this case on the face. So of all the studies I saw, generally both Muslim men and non-Muslim men rated them as less attractive, but non-Muslim men, that is British and American men, they rated hijabs as even more unattractive. Now, you could just say Western men obviously have a cultural bias, so we can discount them. So let's just trust Muslim men and Muslim women's perception as they can give a more objective answer. But remember, the whole purpose of Islamic attire is to limit exposure and attractiveness of women to men. So you would expect both Muslim men and women to have a kind of, yeah, a counterintuitive cultural bias also, because they want the practice of looking modest to be affirmed, to protect their sort of cultural religious worldview. So it's quite difficult to say. But what I would say, though, having looked at the results, is that the studies that included a partially covered option did show differences in how they were perceived by Muslim and non-Muslim men. So in other words, there were three options in these experiments, not two. So you had obviously a full covering of the hijab around the hair. You obviously had, you know, no covering at all where the whole face was exposed. But you also had partially covered option where the heads are sort of the heads are fully covered by the hijab, but the face is obviously revealed, but also the hair, the front of the hair is also, you know, around the forehead is exposed. And what we learned from this was that non-Muslim men judged, you know, Western men judged the partially covered hijabs to be basically just as unattractive as fully covered heads, and that Muslim men judged partially covered heads to be just as attractive as uncovered heads. What this suggests to me is the cultural bias of Western men is stronger than Muslim men, because they basically considered any covering to be unattractive, even you know, even though you with the partially covered head you could still see the hair and ears, which is obviously very important for judging a face. So if we're going to go with the Muslim men's judgment, and I'll admit there are probably still some biases, but hijabs probably do what they're intended, which is to reduce, yeah, exposure. Okay, so I know there was someone in the comments, who was it? Zaki Hidiat, who said that hijabs might create the illusion of symmetry and therefore can presumably make you more attractive. And that's a fair point, actually. But I think the more important factor is the effects that the hijab has on normal processes of facial perception. And in particular, a good deal of evidence. And again, we've covered this in the first episode of this podcast series, which suggests that humans tend to process faces as integrated perceptual wholes rather than, you know, just an accumulation of individual features. And features external to the face, such as hair and ears, may play a crucial role in this process. And indeed, for fully covered images, complete occlusion of hair may provide an especially influential contribution to the reduction in attractiveness. And hair is, of course, one of the more controllable aspects of physical attractiveness, and many women and men, for that matter, spend a great deal of effort, obviously, grooming their hair in order to appear attractive. And this is obviously because hair provides quite a visible indication of a woman's youth and health, which can increase attractiveness quite a lot. It's quite funny because, again, from my personal experience, I went to school in quite a multicultural area. There are a lot of, you know, Muslims of Pakistani origin, and only retrospectively did I come to appreciate that that quite a few of the girls at my school, the Pakistani girls who wore hijabs, were actually quite attractive. It was only afterwards, when I was able to look at facial aesthetics in a more, let's say, systematic or objective way, it was only after then did I realize, actually, you know, they were more attractive than I gave them credit for, just because they were wearing hijabs and covering their hair. So yeah, I guess, at least for me, that tells me that, hair and ears, they're very important features.
Simon has the best of intentions, but I don't think he did a very good job in explaining the role of the hijab when it comes to physical attractiveness. Now, as somebody who was raised in a Muslim family, the hijab is often seen as a expression of choice. Now, in the West, there's this idea that anything to do with the hijab is repressive and it's oppressing women's freedoms. And I guess that explains the biases that Western men have, as Simon was explaining, that when, you know, Western men see a woman with a hijab, they immediately perceive it to be unattractive, and it's some kind of it's kind of like a branding that she's being controlled by another man, when the reality is, you know, knowing lots of Muslim women, being surrounded by a lot of Muslim people, it's more of an expression of choice. And just like you can cover yourself up in many different ways, it's really no different. And so especially the double standard is really funny to me when you compare the nun's habit, which is the Christian epitome of chastity and modesty, and then you compare the hijab, which is the exact same thing, coming from the exact same roots and has the exact same purpose of modesty, but that's seen as oppressive and controlling. So a lot of the results that we're talking about, Simon was talking about, is very much just Western bias. And it is incredibly hard to separate the two, because again, a lot of these studies do come from the West, and most of you live in the West, so you have to understand this is how it will affect you. It will make you less attractive, and to Western men, it will make you considerably less attractive, and that's just the fact. And so unless you're really attractive, you have very ideal symmetry, it makes those flaws much more noticeable, because there isn't much else to work with. That being said, with the hijab being a symbol of modesty, it can make you more desirable, not necessarily attractive, which are two different things, mind you, for a long-term mating context, because men just assume you're more chaste, and you're they also assume other qualities too, much like a halo effect of motherly affection and caring, nurturing abilities for future offspring, so on and so forth.
Okay, so I think that's that really. It's really difficult to say on this particular topic. So yeah, the next question is an anonymous question asked via email, and the question was, what is the most important attractive facial feature for a man? Is it the eye area, jaw area, or something else? So yeah, thank you for that question, and thank you in particular for asking, being very specific and asking for the most important attractive facial feature, because it allows me to frame this in a particular way. If you'd, you know, ask for the more, you know, the most important feature, full stop, I would say the eyes. And the reason for that can be basically just found in our video, why the eyes make or break the face. And the reason for that is just that below optimal eyes with, you know, scleral show or light eyebrows and a sort of bug eye look that protrudes out of the face really can ruin a good face more than any other traits. But just say hypothetically, if you were to say to me, if every facial feature was average, which would you pick to look like a 10 out of 10, if that was even possible, I would have to say the jaw, because the jaw for a man is the most sort of sexually ornamented feature, in that it is most indicative of good genes and of androgenic load, and you know, that is the amount of testosterone one has. So as with most male features, including the nose and eye shape and brow ridges and mouth shape, there are many features you can kind of just get away with. You can get away with a small button nose, for example, if it suits your face shape, and you can get away with a massive, you know, beak-like nose, again, if it suits your face shape. And likewise for eyes, you know, an ultra-feminine brow ridge area, for example, isn't necessarily a deal-breaker, as discussed in the latest Glow Up podcast. I think that was episode 4. But a good jawline, however, is a deal-breaker, always. And you only have to see that sort of Photoshopped image of that guy whose jaw is digitally recessed by a few millimeters to see how important a well-developed jaw is to a man. So I think a better way of putting this would be that the jawline is just less negotiable to your image. And that is to say that the most optimally attractive feature can change depending on your overall facial harmony for most features. So a good example of this, I'm sure you remember that image of a Turkish or Greek guy who got a rhinoplasty and you know reduced his conventionally quite unattractive nose, and that was a sort of aquiline Roman nose to a kind of Nordic button nose, and he actually ended up losing a lot of his facial harmony. And as someone very deftly put on Twitter, wound up from looking like a Greek warrior god to looking like a Starbucks barista. So yeah, that was quite funny. But so yeah, the jaw is not culturally or racially context dependent. A strong mandible shadow and a 90 degree angle is almost always better for a man's face, regardless of the other features. So yeah, I'm not sure if some of the others at Coovs would necessarily agree with me on this, but yeah, what the hell, I think they probably would.
Yeah, no, I agree with Simon. Everything he said is correct. The jaw is arguably one of the most dimorphic features on the human skull, right? The most dimorphic feature, scientifically speaking, is the pelvis. Fun fact, I only found this out quite recently, but the jaw is what separates women from men. And the reason why it's so important is because it's also an indicator of dentofacial health, which is a secondary aspect. So in terms of facial aesthetics, there's genetic things that so nature versus nurture, right? That's nature would be genetics, and then nurture would be dentofacial, your facial development, the types of food you ate, the type of facial exercises you did, if you did any, I don't know. Those are the aspects that control how you were raised. And so the jaw is probably the best example of where you can see both of those things at the same time. And a good example of a face with a strong jaw and maybe unideal eyes or some other feature would be Rami Malek. Very strong jaw, but then his eyes very bug-eyed. And we made a video on this almost 2-3 years ago now. And the gist of it was that because his jaw is so strong, he's still quite an attractive man. And the eyes actually turn into this unique characteristic, this defining feature of Rami. Like, we know him as this kind of bug-eyed dude who's still handsome.
So yeah, moving back to women now, we've got a question from Myla Bow. So thank you, Myla. And she asks, I'm assuming it's a she, could you talk about eyelashes? I feel like putting on mascara makes me so much prettier. I don't feel like putting anything else on my face, and I know so many more girls who, out of all makeup products, only wear mascara. So, yeah, I actually did have to look this up because I don't know a huge amount about eyelashes, but I did find out some interesting things. So, basically, the short answer is having long eyelashes is basically a symbol of good health, just like it is with having thick eyebrows for men and, long hair for women. And the way we know this is that there are, many conditions that can cause them to fall out. And good examples of that are milphosis and madarosis, which I think are autoimmune disorders. And in addition to that, scientists have also found that eyelashes, particularly those that are dark, either, naturally or with mascara, do help to bring out the whites of the eyes, the sclera, and basically the brighter and healthier it is, the more youthful you look. And as you grow older, your eye sclera does actually tend to get less white, basically just more red. Another thing they do is emphasize the limbal ring, which is the dark ring you see around your iris. Which has long been associated with attractiveness and is also most prominent during your fertile years. So they begin to fade and recede starting in your late 20s, and they just decline from there. And interestingly, it seems that there is research to show that the blink of a woman is much slower than a man's. So that presumably helps to, you know, contribute to the sort of fluttering eyelash look that women do to you know, get what they want. But yeah, so for mascara in particular, my impression is that it's something to do with making the eyes look larger, which, it, you know, is, kind of relates to what I was saying about the sclera. And it's difficult to say where eyes are placed in terms of importance of attractiveness for women. I know for men it's very high in terms of looking you know, thin and hooded, you know, more intimidating, that sort of hunter eye look. You'll of course know from, you know, watching the video I spoke about earlier, why eyes make or break the face. For women, it's probably just, you know, mascara just accentuates, probably for you and for many of your friends, what are probably quite large eyes. And, you know, this is purely from personal experience, so don't completely take my word for it. But I feel like mascara is also the least noticeable makeup. Like, foundation is always obvious, as is lipstick and eyeshadow. But I feel like, you know, I don't feel like using a mascara makes it obvious you're wearing makeup, particularly if it's, you know, the only thing you're doing. So yeah, my impression is that it's a good way for women to basically add contrast and make their eyes look brighter and larger, you know, without being too noticeable. Huang Nguyen? Yeah, it's about photos. I think I could probably do a whole video on that. Actually, no. Kuv's has done a video on that. I've forgotten what it's called, but if you just type in Kuv Studio, why you look so much better in real life than photos, you'll find our video on that. That's quite a good video. It's about a year ago.
The short answer is because of what's known as the mirror exposure effect. You look better in the mirror because that's what you're used to. That's the side of your... All of the symmetries, they're on one side of your face, and so when you flip it around in a photo, they're on another side, and that's not a face you're exposed to, mirror exposure again, and so it looks like a new face, a completely different face, and you start to pick out the flaws in the photograph much more than you pick out the flaws in a mirror because you've been looking at it so much. So the effect here is the mirror exposure effect. If you Google that, you'll get a better answer, or watch the video that we put out a couple of years ago.
Alex C on LGBT, yeah, okay, so that's very interesting. I'll just do a whole podcast episode on that. That's very interesting. It's basically on how beauty standards change according to sexual orientation, but that's very interesting. But I will do a whole episode on that. Okay, Gary S, I've heard that you can get an idea of your attractiveness by looking at the average of the people who are attracted to you. How true is that? I hope there's no truth in it, because I feel like most of the people who have tried to talk to me fall in the 3 to 4 range on a 1 to 10 scale of attractiveness. I'd like to think I am a solid 7 or 8, but the quality of faces that attempt to talk to me makes me think otherwise. Please help. Well, Gary, I won't spend too long on this because I'm not really sure, you know, dating advice is what I can really offer, but I think that's just basically because most women who are around a 7 or an 8 don't really need to force a situation where they can talk to you, because I think that's kind of what they're expecting you to do. But of course, yeah, men who are less discerning, you know, can be led to believe that they're less good looking than they are because of the litany of, you know, less good looking women, or conventionally good looking women, who are, you know, very interested, and that can make you maybe quite complacent, and, you know, makes you less likely to put in any work yourself. But yeah, like I said, this isn't really for dating advice.
So to help Simon and to help answer Gary's question, I'm gonna throw in my 2 cents. There is some truth to your attractiveness being determined as a sum of the people that are attracted to you. But mind you, as Simon was kind of leading on to, when it comes to men getting hit on by women, generally more attractive women don't need to force a situation, as Simon was saying. And as a result, what happens is it's not a true indicator of, you know, the people that are attracted to you. More correctly, very attractive women may be attracted to you, but they just don't hit on you, they don't make the effort, because in the past they've never had to. And mind you, these might be conventionally attractive women. And so it's not a true, the people that hit on you isn't a good metric for how attractive you might be, if we're going by the theory that your attractiveness is a sum of the people that are attracted to you. Rather, there's no way that you can realistically tell. Most people that are attracted to you are not going to come up to you and say, hey, I'm attracted to men or women, and so I wouldn't lose any sleep over it. But I guess if you have a friend group and people in your friend group are attracted to you and they're all very attractive, then that means you're attractive. If they're not very attractive, that could also mean you're still attractive, but it also might mean that you're approachable, you're seen as not as attractive, that you're intimidating, but attractive enough to be desirable, but also approachable. You're at risk of falling into a logical fallacy, and so I wouldn't exactly equate one thing to another. Just because they're attracted to you doesn't mean that you are attractive, and just because they're not attracted to you doesn't mean you are unattractive. What I'm saying is that there is some truth to it, and it may apply in the majority of situations, but not in all situations.
Why do evolutionary psychologists like David Buss talk so little about the importance of appearance, but always talk about how women select men heavily on status and income? In reality, if they were free to choose without economic or cultural pressures, they would always choose someone they were physically attracted to in the first place. Well, Bob, I often ask myself the same question. I think the answer is that most would give to this is basically correct, which is that attractiveness is, or at least for men, is just a prerequisite for sorting from which high status wealthy men to choose from. Because, you know, in this modern age, with dating apps and with geographic mobility, you know, women have so many options, particularly now we're moving towards a more kind of serial monogamous or semi-polygamous society, that, you know, now we're in that situation that it's just not even a factor that consciously comes into things, because most women are generally choosing from a pool of already physically attractive men, and then they use the wealth or status or power of the men to choose between them, which kind of gives them the illusion that it is wealth or status that matters more. Like we've said so many times on this podcast, women do have a much harder minimum threshold. And when that can be met, why do women even need to consciously think about attractiveness anymore? So of course, when they're, you know, asked about it in surveys, they do generally say that wealth and status matter more. So to be fair to David Buss, he is going off real data. He's just not really reading between the lines. Another thing is that this data is coming from a very particular Western Eurocentric context, where women have the luxury of sorting between and therefore basically excluding 70% of the men before they even, you know, think about, not even just before they make their decision, it's before they even think about making their decision. I mean, for example, I find it quite interesting that when you watch interviews of East Asian women, where they, you know, they still have quite traditional monogamous values, when they're asked for what they look for in a man, for first and foremost, they always, you know, they almost always tend to say looks. In fact, in the English-speaking world, I don't even hear the word handsome anymore. I just don't hear anyone using that word. It's just a dead word. But, you know, when these interviewers ask Chinese or Japanese women who speak English as a second language, they still do use that word quite regularly. So, you know, I know the stereotype is that women in East Asia are happy to go for not so good looking men because they're from a quote unquote high status country. You know, I can tell you for a fact that, you know, well, not for a fact, but, you know, from the evidence I've seen, that it doesn't seem to be true. And it's just based on quite outdated stereotypes. And quite a lot of men are finding that, you know, when they go to East Asia, it's not quite as easy to attract women as they expect.
To add on to what Simon has said, I think that in both the Eastern and Western spheres, looks is just as important, because it's a very much biological thing, and that's what we're seeing in the research, in the literature. But when we downplay it, and this is a very much Western thing, I think the Eastern cultures are much more pragmatic about how looks, it's just like another thing. It's like you have money, status, and looks. But in the West, looks is tied to race, racial features, racial archetypes, and that's tied to identity politics, and people just love to talk about their races and identity, and there's so much stuff, and it's a very touchy subject. And so for those reasons, we downplay the importance of looks. We try to pretend like it's this elephant in the room that just doesn't exist, when in reality it does exist. And when researchers like David Buss are looking at the data, like Simon is saying, I don't think they're looking explicitly between the lines, or that they're taking the data at face value, when in reality, I think if you think about the type of responses that women are expected to give to a researcher in a non-anonymous setting, which is what a lot of these studies are, then obviously they're not going to say looks is the most important aspect, or it's an important aspect at all, maybe equally to status and money. They might just say it's not important at all, and instead say personality or something else is important, when in reality, I've said reality three times now, when in reality the actual physical experiences that unattractive people have doesn't equate to that. And I just don't understand why we're so shy about talking about looks. It's just like money. It's just like status. It's just another one of those things that you need. And there's nothing wrong with desiring a attractive partner. It's not something we should be ashamed of.
Okay, so the next question is from N. Inch. And he asks, could you talk about dimples? What causes them and why are they attractive? So, yeah, in terms of what causes them, apparently they're caused by a change in the zygomaticus major, which is a facial muscle that helps you to smile, basically. So yeah, in people without dimples, this muscle usually begins at the zygoma bone in your cheek, and then it kind of runs downwards, connecting to the corner of your mouth. But with people in dimples, on the other hand, apparently it kind of, this muscle divides into, two separate parts of muscle on its way down to the mouth. And, one part of it connects at the corner of the mouth, and then the other connects below the corner of the mouth and is, tethered to the skin above it. So this split basically causes movement of the skin over this second zygoma muscle when you smile, which is what causes the dimple to form. So we'll go for one more. This one is from Will Tacula, and he says, is gum chewing, in your opinion, helpful for people with small bigonial width? Perhaps they can work to achieve that Brad Pitt look. Well, yeah, I'm going to be very lazy on this one and just refer you to episode 2 of the Glow Up podcast with Shafi and JC the Catalyst, because they talk all about the jawline and particularly all the techniques that people use to improve it. So yeah, the answer is basically yes, but there are quite a few options. So yeah, you'd be probably better off listening to that than to me.
To answer his question, in post-production, I would just say that it can help, but not as much. So chewing gum is not going to help your jaw width as much as you expect it to help. It will make a little bit of a change, but not as much. You're not going to get the Brad Pitt jaw, I'm afraid to say. It just, I very much think that a lot of these jaw products that are being sold are scams, and they cause more harm than good. A good example is temporomandibular joint disorder. We covered that on the podcast, so we did make a good detailed video on that, and there's obviously the podcast.
So yeah, I think that's about it. Thank you very much for your questions. They were really fun to think about, and I learned a lot as well, particularly the questions on dimples and eyelashes, which I probably should have known about anyway. So yeah, if you guys want me to do another Q&A, I'm more than happy to do that. And as a side note, we'll be having a very special guest on in a few weeks. He's a very exciting thinker and up-and-coming evolutionary psychologist from University of Cambridge. So yeah, keep an eye out for that.
A hearty goodbye, and thank you for listening from me as well. As always, you can catch this episode on the Patreon podcast because this is part of the exclusive episodes that we do on Patreon, but there is also the Glow Up and Deep Dive podcast, which is what we do with other co-hosts, like from JC the Catalyst and Simon. And so that's on Spotify. That's free to listen to. It's on Apple Music and all the other platforms as well. And we actually don't make any money from any of these podcasts. We don't have any sponsors, or nor do we want any sponsors. So I saw a comment that's like, Coovs doesn't just put these, they just put this information out for the goodness of their heart. No, with these podcasts, we very much do it. And sometimes I wonder why I do it. But, you know,